Good evening, everybody. Welcome to a new series, Substance Use and Abuse in Judaism. So for tonight, we're going to be starting with alcohol through Noah's glass. So I'm going to be screen sharing. And at any point, if you have any questions, feel free to chime in. I can see you on the side. So feel free to call it out in case you think I can't see your hand waving. So before we get into the actual evening, I'd like to first present the menu, right? So we're going to be discussing various types of alcohol as seen in Tanakh. We're going to be discussing the effects of alcohol. We're going to be discussing the various mitzvot that are related to alcohol, the dangers of alcohol, as well as certain stories of alcohol that will hopefully educate us as towards what we're supposed to do with the all the alcohol that we see all around us. So on to the first topic, namely the when do we see the term alcohol come up in Tanakh? So we see the term, the most common term is obviously yayin, which is wine, right? That's the most common alcohol that we see, followed a close second by tirosh, which is also almost 40 times. And then, you know, smattering of other terms that are debatably Hebrew or Aramaic that also can imply wine, but again, they're there for your information. You don't need to worry about it because, well, they all basically mean the same thing. And if you were to have looked it up in an English translation, they would all just be wine. The other form of alcohol that you see in Tanakh is beer. You'll see that as shechar. In case you're wondering, where is the good old whiskey and everything else nice and tasty? The answer is it wasn't invented yet, right? The what is known in Hebrew as yayin saraf, right, which means hard liquor. So it's not invented until much later in history. So if you're hoping to see it in Tanakh, I'm sorry, you're off by several hundred years. So now that we have know a little bit about what we're looking at in terms of the alcohol that's used in Tanakh, so let's now discuss a little bit what positive mitzvot there might be with wine and alcohol in general. So if I had to ask you, you know, what were some positive mitzvot that, you know, perhaps even mandate the usage of alcohol, like what would you say? Feel free to before I have my list, let's see what everybody's thinking. When you think of a mitzvah with alcohol, what do you think of?
Kiddush, bris.
A kiddush, a bris.
Weddings.
Weddings.
Pesach.
I see Karen had the four cups, right? For Pesach. Right? So those are the mitzvahs that we automatically think of. But that's not actually all of the times we see mitzvot involving alcohol. So, true, but that's rabbinic. We're going to get there too. Don't worry. For more on that side of things, we'll be having one dedicated just to drinking on Purim. Don't worry. So we'll get there. So, but there's two groupings of types of mitzvot that we have. Namely, there is the positive and the negative. Right. So let's first start with the positive ones. Okay. So as far as times when yes to wine. Right, the most frequent mitzvah is actually the libation of wine. Right, so this is something that's done multiple times a day in the Beit Hamikdash and Mishkan as well. Right, the fact that whenever you brought a korban, you would typically also bring some sort of libation, meaning you pour off some wine. Right, it's in Hebrew called nisuch hayayin. Right, you'll often see v'niskehem. Right, so whenever you see that, when it says v'niskehem, things like that, that's always referring to, right, libating wine, pouring it as part of the korbanot. So then, as we mentioned earlier, right, we've got kiddush, right. Also, right on the flip side, both to start as well as to end, also havdalah, right, also requires wine, the four cup, the seder night. Right. Also utilized in benching, and as mentioned by at wedding, various parts of the wedding, Brit Milah. So, also hoping somebody would say, but nobody mentioned, is the fact that it's considered to be an integral part of sacred having joy at a holiday. Right. You can't have it's not considered to be a joyous occasion without wine. Right. So that's seen in the Psukim, and also you see it on Purim as well. Right. So again, that was mentioned. But we also see that it comes up Sorry, I'm going to move the windows because I can't block myself, right? So also we see sometimes when there's definitely wine being a bad thing, primarily in two mitzvot, namely that of a nazir, where you say that you'll have no more wine, whether that's good or bad is a different discussion, right? Again, which we will not have time to get into this evening, but suffice it to say that that is, again, is the nazir good or bad character will determine whether or not his perspective on wine is positive or negative. And there's also the idea of whether or not you're allowed to enter the Mishkan or the Beit HaMikdash while you are under the influence of alcohol of any sort. And there it seems like you clearly are not. Right? So that's in
9 days.
For the 9 days. So that's in terms of that's the rabbinic one tied to the joy that normally comes with wine. And in times of sadness, we don't utilize. But excellent point, Mark. Thank you. Right? So we'll get there. Right? So that's not a mitzvah. That's a side effect of what wine. It's a side effect of wine side effect, if that makes sense. So, and so now that we have some idea of some of the mitzvot that include wine, we still haven't actually explained what wine is. So, as far as for what wine is, so we'll go with the right. We'll try. So, as in wine is again fermented grapes, right? The main point that people find interesting about wine is not that it's, you know, for our purposes, the main effect isn't simply due to its being, you know, very, you know, its nice aroma, its rich taste, it being oaky, whatever nice phrase you might see in a wine bottle. But the question is, what effects does wine have on an individual, which is the main thought of why somebody would consider consuming wine. So what are some of the, when we think of wine and its effects, what are some of the we think of immediately? This is open to the floor.
When wine comes in, secrets come out.
Very good. When wine comes in, secrets come out. So that would put that under the inebriation category. Right? As in, you know, you might lose some judgment. What else?
Supposed to make you happy.
Make you happy. Yeah, is he?
Wine is a depressant.
A depressant, uh-huh. Meaning it will make it'll suppress certain parts of your mood for better or for worse, depending on the situation. Right, so as far as the technical terms of the, now that since Izzy brought up depressant, right? So the technical way that alcohol works is you eat or drink the alcohol, goes into your bloodstream, then it reaches your brain, crosses over the blood-brain barrier, and then it directly ends up affecting your neural processes. So for exactly how that works, please consult your local doctor. I believe we do have some doctors on the call. On the Zoom, so they'll be able to tell you far more about the technicalities of how that works. But the point being is thank you, Dr. Denisov. Right. So again, if you have any particular questions about the how of it, please talk to Dr. Denisov. That is not my field of expertise. Suffice it to say, it does have an effect. So, but let's go through the colloquial ones and as we see them both in terms of again ones that were mentioned as well as how they come up in terms of the Gemara and elsewhere. So let's take a look. So right, so the first one, right, as was mentioned, is that it makes you happy, right? It gladdens, right? Ein simcha lo yayin, there's no joy unless there's wine, right? So we see this comes up in several verses, right? One is, we see it coming up in, the most famous one is probably v'yayin yisamach v'av enosh from Tehillim, that wine cheers up the hearts of men. But as far as wine, it doesn't only make men happy, as pointed out by Yotam in his parable, when after he escaped the attempted murder of his brother Avimelech, yeah. For more on that, I recommend you take a look at Baby Dress Nikondov's Tanakh in a Day, where I discussed just that. Right, that whole story. But the point being there is that the grapevine explains that, you know, why would it not want to be in charge? It's like the grapevine is happy with its role in life, namely making men and God happy. Right? If you had to say, like, you know, is that a job well done? Wine's been doing it since the beginning of time. It's happy where it is. Doesn't need to be king. It's already the king of all the good fruits. Doesn't need to be, you know, the formal title. It knows who's in charge. So right. So that's one aspect. Right. One is that wine can make you happy. So, but another effect is that also based on the depressant effect. So, as in, not necessarily that'll make you depressed, but that can happen. But that's not why most will tend not to drink wine to cause that. But sometimes by depressing certain emotions and feelings, it can allow one to become comforted, such as the Gemara in Erevin, which says that Rabbi Chanin, who says that the purpose behind behind wine is because it comforts mourners, right? People can't handle extreme emotions, so they utilize wine to temper it, right? So this seemingly is a positive usage of wine, not so bad. Conversely, we have the on the opposite side, we have in terms of not just depressing, but some say it might even stimulate the brain, as seen by the Radak, right? Rav David Kimchi on his commentary on to the above verse from Tehillim says that if you drink wine properly, it can actually make you wise. So whether or not that actually is scientifically true, the answer is it doesn't. But people can, but as far as, you know, roughly, as in, as I'm sure people know, like if you were to have, you know, drinking wine and any amount will detract in your motor skills, your cognitive abilities. So that's not necessarily the case, but there is that idea that floats around and people lead to the impression of making them wiser. Okay. And then last but not least, there's the most obvious one, right? What is an effect that wine can have? It can give you to bring you to various states of drunkenness. So one of them, the most, you know, the press itself after effect of drunkenness might be the lowering of inhibitions. You may have heard wine or other alcohols referred to as liquid courage, right? But of course, corresponding to that of lowering your inhibitions and making you more courageous, it also, you know, as was mentioned by Mark, right? You know, wine enters and secrets leave. So it might be positive, but also it can also lead to some very negative things as well. Okay, and then of course, as mentioned before, another side effect is you're less good at hand-eye coordination, which we'll see that plays a role as well. Okay, oh, that reminds me before I forget. Yeah, I'm gonna put some. If somebody happens to want to is not receiving emails, I would like to. So please, you can sign up. You either drop your email in the chat, or you can. That didn't come up as a HTTP. So either go to tinycc.com/drugspanel, or you can drop your email in the chat, and I can sign you up. And also, if you would like to have a copy of the PowerPoint, it's also listed right there. Okay. So again, if anybody's looking for that, that's where that is. So now that we've established some of the basic effects of wine, it's important now to take a look at some of the stories involving wine in Tanakh, right? So as far as figuring out what the message of the usage of wine is, I find the easiest way to understand it, again, there is also the halakhic realm, but for more on that, I can point you to many excellent shiurim, such as that of Rabbi Trichina's on the topic. Or hopefully a lot of that stuff will come up in future lectures as well. But for now, let's start with the more hashkafic one, which I think can be gleaned a little bit better from various stories in Tanakh. So when you think of stories in Tanakh involving wine, which ones jump out at you?
Noah,
very good. What else?
Samson, Lot,
right? Two very different stories. One is lack of wine, yet it still looks bad, versus one with lots.
Yain, the sons of Aaron.
Right, Nadav v'Avihu, right? Their improper usage also is going to play a role.
Spies. Well, it's grapes.
They bring grapes, right? Very good. Right? So there's a lot of stories. I apologize for the slight oversimplification, but we're going to put them into the categories of good stories and bad stories. Okay, so again, each of these there will be more nuanced, but for now, let's put it in terms of the good versus bad stories. So negative stories. So from that would be the ones that we most remembered, such as Noah, which we'll be discussing more in depth. That of Lot and his daughters, Nadav v'Avihu. Right, the sons of Aaron, as they improperly intoxicated according to the Midrash, and then they and the Gemara, and therefore they are put to death for doing the service while drunk. It's also utilized in terms of various assassination attempts at various points in Tanakh, such as Absalom's assassination of Amnon. And of course, the part that we often forget is that there are many exhortations by a whole slew of different prophets. This is not a full list, it's a partial list. If you'd like a full list, you could look at, check your concordance under Shikur, and you'll notice that most of the times when somebody's drinking it, or the term a drunk is used, it is not used in a positive fashion. It is very often used to say, why are you drunk, right? And that is not a good thing to be, either because, and for reasons which we will hopefully discuss more in depth when we're analyzing the other stories, right? Drinking is frowned upon, either because it can lead to, you know, ignoring reality. It could be because you are due to improper overindulgence. And more in that vein, again, we'll unfortunately not have enough time to discuss all of them tonight, but hopefully if you'd like to look more, I'm happy to send you more sources and we can look through another point, more drinking stories. And then we get to the ones that are potentially positive ones, some of which were mentioned, some of which were not. So as far as the positive usage of Tanakh, so whenever there is a large feast in Tanakh, it also is accompanied by wine. You can't, right? So we see that in several feasts. We see that in Abraham's feast that's presented to him by Mal Shalem. We see it by Yosef and his brothers when the celebratory feast is finally being able to eat with them. But that also has the negative connotations a little bit because after the meal, you know, Yosef continues to set up his brothers. We see it being utilized in various holidays, celebrations of the Beit Hamikdash, as well as insert any other feast. When it says Vayishtu and they drank, it's referring to their having drinking and being merry as part of the festive meal. We also have the role in the Purim story, which again, unfortunately, we'll not have time to discuss at length tonight. But if you'd like to hear me discuss that, please stop by Midrashat Yom Rishon. It'll be at Midrashat Yom Rishon for Women. It'll be in person at Clanton Park on the 27th of February. And if you can't make, and also it's going to be on Zoom as well for all those who are more inclined to be for Zoom goers than in-person goers. Also, again, as you mentioned before, right, wine is used as an example of happiness in various stories, right? Wine is an expression of people being joyous. And last but not least, it's utilized as a source of blessing well over a dozen times throughout Tanakh, perhaps more famously in terms of the blessing that Yaakov gives to his son Yehuda, then of Bereishit, or you might remember it from the Shema, right? When we say, if we listen to the mitzvot of God, that God will reward us with plentiful tiroshcha v'yitzarecha, where God will bless our wine harvests as well as our olive oil harvests, right? So we see that there's very much a negative and positive usage of wine in terms of Tanakh. But the question is, when we say there's negative and positive wine usage, so as it looks right now, it's not entirely clear what's negative and what's positive. So for that, let's take a little closer look. So the best story, in my opinion, is also the first story. Right, what is the first story we have involving alcohol in Tanakh? Right, mentioned earlier. Right, it's Noah. Right, right. He's the first time that we see anybody being drunk. Right, so he gets the illustrious or noble title of being the first drunk in history. So now let's go through a story and see what. Isn't if this is the first introduction we have to a vineyard and to wine, how that will color the rest of our view of the discussion. So just a little bit of background before we leap into the story itself. So this is taking place at the very, very end of the Noah story. We already had God condemning the entirety of the world to destruction, except for Noah, for their sins, for there being a large degree of Hamas, meaning of being brazen robbery and lawlessness throughout the land. And therefore God decides to bring a flood onto the whole world. And then Noah is commanded to build an ark to save his family as well as the animals. That way, even after the flood, the world will continue anew. Hopefully, you know, this time on the right path, as opposed to in the dark path that they had been following since the sin of Adam and Chava, then Cain murdering Hevel, and everything going really quickly downhill from there. So here we have, again, after their year on the ark, they got off, right? And then when they got off, so then by command of God, so Noach is seemingly riding high, because when he gets off, not only does he converse with God, but God actually gives him a covenant, the Brit Keshet, the covenant of the rainbow. And not only that, but we also see that Noach is offering sacrifices to God as thanks for saving him and for all that has happened over the past year, and that he finally managed to live on dry land, and that the terrible flood has been finished. And then we get to the end of chapter 9, and something very different starts to happen. So we see them all come out, and then we see that Noach begins to be an Ish Adama. Vayachal Noach, Ish Adama, Vayitakaren. Right? All of a sudden, Noach begins to be a man of the earth and plants a vineyard. And then what does he do? He plants a vineyard, then Vayesh, Minayayim, Vayishkar, Vayitgal, Betocholo. Right? So he drinks from the wine and he gets drunk. He becomes a cover in his tent. And then his son Cham notices and then says, hey, look, dad's drunk and naked. And then his brothers, Shem and Yafet, realize, wait a minute, that's bad. And they decide to they respectfully turn their backs and cover Noach. And when Noach awakes, he curses Canaan, the son of Cham, that they shall be slaves, but blesses Shem and Yafet such that they will be the rulers as opposed to Canaan, who will be their slaves. And then Noach lives for 350 more years, and then that's it for Noach. So based on the story here, like, what would you think is the view on, is alcohol a good thing or a bad thing? Like, what would we be inclined to say?
Here it's bad.
Right? Right, very bad. What else? Right. So, based on the simple stories we see here, what happens when you drink wine? If you drink wine, you're going to get drunk. You're going to wind up exposing yourself and cursing your kids. And not only that, you'll probably also fade off into history as a drunkard. Right. So it seems to be a very quick and slippery slope argument that, you know, wine, stay very far away. Any other suggestions? Is there any other way to read this that we can think of?
That's interesting. I mean, Noach was drunk. It has led to his son behaving inappropriately also and taking advantage of him.
Right. So there's also the issue that when we drink, it can also have a negative effect on those around us. Right. You might think that, oh, you know, all I'm doing is, you know, drinking, but you forget there's other people around you. So the question also will come up, what drove Noach to drink? Right. What would you think the reason is that he drank?
Despair that most of the world died.
Despair, right? He was sad and he decided to go hide in a bottle of wine. Right. So did that have the effect that he wanted in the end? I think not. Right. I think the end result from what he may it happened is the exact opposite of what he wanted.
So one question is.
Oh, sorry. I mute yourself. I heard there was some. Yeah, go for it.
So one question is, did Noach know he was going to get drunk drinking wine? Right.
Very good. Right. Was it intentional?
Right. Did he know what was going to happen? He planted a vineyard. Maybe he made wine for the first time. He didn't know what was going to happen.
Right. So do we think this was the first time that somebody got drunk in history? Right. Did he not have? He had no idea. Right. He simply, he knew he liked grapes, so he figured, I know what would be a delicious drink. Let's have grape juice. And oops, turns out his grape juice was wine, and that's what happened. But the only problem with saying that is that, well, he had to plant a vineyard, wait for a long enough time for it to reach a, it has to be, again, months of planting before from planting till harvest. And then he had to have waited several days in order for it to ferment it. So to say that he didn't know is a little bit of a stretch, but we definitely can say that. So, right, so as far as somebody wanted an imagery for how the whole thing went, so this is This is in the mind of Italian artist Giovanni Bellini from the 16th century, right? This is how he views the drunkenness of Noah, right? Noah is, you know, there, right? You know, nothing dignified about it, right? He simply, you know, hit in the wine, and that's his end.
One second. Rabbi Chaim? Okay.
Yes.
So obviously, though, he wasn't the first well-known drunk in history. But the fact that his son came in and said, our father is drunk, must mean that they knew what drunk was before his father got drunk. So his father wasn't the first drunk. He was just the most famous first drunk. Do you know what I'm saying? He was the original drunk because right. They had to know what drunk was.
Right. So technically what Chaim said was that I see my dad naked. Right. And that's what he tells, not the drunken part, but the nakedness part. So the aftermath of the drinking is seemingly the part that grabs Chaim's attention. So we'll have to take, you know, we'll have to revisit this. Okay. So as far as ways to read the story, so there's quite a few. So here are some that I've seen. Again, so this is going to be a wide range. Hopefully this will, you know, depending on how you read it, will be whether or not you can stomach wine in general. All right, so let's first start with the first one that was suggested by, I believe, by Dr. Denisov and Mark had mentioned, right? The simple answer is drinking is bad, right? It leads to Noah getting, you know, exposing himself, cursing his grandkids, and fading into history. As far as support for that, his fading into history part, so I'd like to point out that anybody know how old, timeline-wise, when Noah passed away at the age of 950, who else was currently alive? Anybody know?
Abram,
very good, right? Abram Avinu was already in his 50s when Noah passed 48. Away.
48.
So
he was 50 years old.
Right, he's around 50 years old. So, as far as proof that, you know, was Noach a nobody, in the time of Avram, which is, you know, the famous question that Rashi brings, two answers: maybe he'd been greater, maybe he would have been a great man if he was in a better generation, or he would have been a nobody in a greater generation. But the reality was that Noach was around for the first, you know, significant portion of Avram's life, and nobody knew that he was there. So, which in my mind leads me to think that, well, Noach drank in the story, and then he proceeded to, that was only the first of the many times that he ended up hiding in that alcohol was his crutch, and maybe he just, you know, ended up living out the rest of his life trying to self-medicate with wine, which would be a terrible way to continue with the rest of the last 350 years of his life. So, but another option is, in terms of how to read the story, is you can change the way the drinking went down. So what do I mean by that? So one question is to change the amount of drinking. We mentioned before about the potential of the Radak quotes of drinking for the sake of being wise. So that's also the idea put forth by Fall of Alexandria, a Jew from Alexandria from the first century BCE, right? Who wrote a commentary on the Septuagint. Meaning, he spoke Greek, so he did it based off the Septuagint, the Greek translation of Tanakh. So he wrote a lot of treatises based on it. And so his explanation for what happened with the Noah story is he said, no, Noah didn't really get drunk. He drank like a wise man. And but he was drunk. He wasn't really drunk, right? He just, like, you know, his clothing fell off, right? He didn't drink like a drunkard does. He drank like a wise man, and, you know, maybe, you know, he fell asleep and he wasn't wearing clothes, but it started out very, very good. So another option is and this reading might be a lot harder for us to swallow than even that one, which is namely that he didn't drink at all, which is the opinion of the Genesis Apocryphon, one of the Dead Sea Scrolls, that basically rereads the entire story as a prophetic scene, right? It was all just a dream. So Noah never got drunk. He simply had a dream, and in the dream he drank, but he never actually drank in real life, and therefore it's okay. Noah didn't get drunk, but it would still teach us a lesson of drinking being bad. But there's another option, right? Is that you can say that the drinking itself, like, yes, did Noah get drunk, and did the story happen? So that's bad. But there, we could also change the circumstances of how he gets drunk can also very much affect the way you'd view it, right? If you change the context. So if you look at the Book of Jubilees, again, this is a work not by Chazal. It was done by, it was a work most likely written by somebody who was a Sadducee in the time of the late Second Temple, right? So the Book of Jubilees, right, which has various laws in it that tend to support a non-rabbinic view, namely that it's more akin to the Sadducees. So in Jubilees, so the story changes. So we have added in the first libation in history. In addition to Noah being the first person to offer a korban, a sacrifice to God, he's also, meaning in the new world. So he starts with the new world. Not only does he offer a nice sacrifice, but that sacrifice comes along with the libations. That's why he had it built to plant the vineyard, because you can't properly serve God without a libation. As I'm sure we all know, if you don't libate, then you didn't really pray properly. Get back to that. Don't worry. Right. So, and then afterwards, right. And where is he drinking? He's not drinking to hide from his problems. Rather, he's drinking at a celebratory feast. And then as part of that celebratory feast, he gets a little drunk, but not to worry. Even though he got drunk that one time, what does he do afterwards? He picks himself right back up and does a whole slew of good deeds for the betterment of mankind, setting up the stage for the future and all being well for the rest of humankind. Right, that is Jubilee's very creative rereading of the story, which even though yes, Noah did drink, but again, it was an accident, not so bad. Another option is, which was mentioned by Dr. Genizo, is that maybe he was the first one to drink, and therefore, right, it's an accident, which would in turn perhaps let us save Noah, but it would not let us think that wine is any better because, well, once you know wine is bad. Right, the first time we'll let fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. Fool me thrice, well, I guess I'm a fool. Right, so then yeah, so at a certain point, Noach is considered to be at fault. But that's only the first story we had. Right, so there's the next story where wine plays an extremely prominent role in the plot development is that of the story of Lot and his daughters. So here, in the interest of time, I'll explain it outside, right? So after the destruction of Sodom, so Lot and his daughters are fleeing, right? And they turn back when they shouldn't have, and they notice that they don't turn back. Like, that's what Lot's wife does. It gets turned into a pillar of salt. But they do hear, basically it sounds like the world around them collapsing as there's fire and brimstone raining from heaven. And they go run and hide out in the cave, and hope that, they'll be able to survive. But when they get into the cave, so Lot's two daughters say, our father's old and everybody else is dead. So if we don't get pregnant now from our father, mankind's going to end. So let's do it quickly. So what they do is they made their father drink. And then the firstborn lay with her father. And then he did not notice what went on. And then the next day, the younger daughter did it. And then from there came the children of Ammon and Moab, the progenitors of the nation of Bnei Ammon and Moab, which come up throughout the rest of Tanakh, right? Those two nations that are in to the southeast of Israel, right? So those are based on this incestuous relationship, which was all done thanks to them drugging their father with alcohol. So based on that, it would seem that, well, now we have two stories. There's clearly no way to save alcohol. Alcohol is clearly terrible, right? What's the only result of alcohol? Alcohol is a drunkenness, which leads to either cursing your kids or incest, both of which are things that are really, really bad, and you should stay as far, far, far away from it as you possibly can. So as far as why this, you could extend this reasoning to service of God, right? So just like it happened badly there. So of course, why do you have your wits about you when you are serving God or anything else? The answer is because, right? So this is from the Sefer Achinuch, an anonymous work written by one of the Rishonim in honor of his son's bar mitzvah, explaining the 613 mitzvot, as well as the reasoning behind them and some of the laws about them. So here was explaining why you're not supposed to go drunk into the temple and not be drunk while you are making a halakhic decision and meaning it, doing anything in regards to the words of the Torah. So he explains, the root of the commandment is well known, that it is only fitting to be involved in extremely precious things like matters of the temple and words of Torah at the time that a man is settled in his thoughts and focused in all of his actions. There's no need to write at length about obvious things. All right, so here it seems straightforward. Wine, very bad. No way to save it, right? Wine is like, you know, there are times when you kind of need it for things, but like in general, you stay away. When there's anything else important going on, wine should be as far away as possible. So that sounds nice and all, but the only problem is that we know that we saw there's tons of mitzvot. So like, so how do we, you know, reconcile the two of them? So one answer is that simply it depends on when, right? Sometimes you can use alcohol, sometimes not. So the case comes up in the Gemara in Erevin, right? Where Rabbi Yehuda told Shmuel that, as similar as we see before, that you can't make a halakhic ruling while drunk. And even if you drank only a quarter log, meaning around 3 ounces of wine, right, which is not a lot. Again, standard glass of wine is around 5 ounces. So, and they're referring to diluted wine, so it's even less, right? Then you can't make a halakhic ruling. But if Nachman said, what do you mean? Right? That's not really true because for myself, if I haven't had a drink, I can't actually make a halakhic ruling, which is troubling because you're like, wait, isn't there a biblical prohibition to not do that? Like, what are you saying, Rav Nachman? So Rava says that's crazy, right? Do you really want to keep such company with prostitutes and waste your fortune, right? So meaning that if you were to do something that's not so nice, i.e., you're somebody who's known to be drinking while giving halakhic advice, that you are going to lose the fortune of Torah, and that Rav Nachman was like, you're right, maybe I shouldn't be drinking while doing that, and then he stopped saying those sorts of things. So from here, it seems like, so why you shouldn't, we know. But what did Rav Nachman had in mind? Did wine really make his mind clearer? So as far as, we mentioned earlier that people do perceive wine as making you wiser, but sometimes it's just making you wiser because it allows you to relax and forget your inhibitions and your fears. So it's not that you're truly any wiser. Just before, you might have been overly concerned with, or rightfully so, about the weight of what your decision is going to be. But once you have a little bit of alcohol in you, you'll be easier to make a decision because you're no longer as worried about making a mistake, and you might end up making that very self same mistake. So that's, you know, one type of, you know, of drinking. Right, drinking a little bit maybe make you wiser, but odds are it won't. But there's also the question of, are you allowed to drink during prayer? So has anybody here ever heard of a time maybe when there's, you know, drinking in the middle of a prayer before that we can think of? I think you're muted.
Simchat Torah.
Right, Simchat Torah, right? As in like, wait, how can you drink in the middle of prayers? Right, so... Well, the answer is, you really can't, right? So what do you mean that you can't? Like, what does that mean? So let's take a closer look. So here the Gemara continues, talking about, are you allowed to be drunk when you pray? Right? So Rabbi Bar Huna says, one who is drunk cannot pray, but if you prayed, it's still fine. But if you're intoxicated, if you're a shikor, then it is not considered to be prayer. Rather, your prayer becomes an abomination. So then the Gemara, again, this is a continuation of the Gemara before from Erevin. So then what is the amount? And it says, what is somebody who had some wine? Is somebody who is able to talk in the presence of the king? So that's, again, a light degree of alcohol such that doesn't yet influence you, which we generally assume to be the same measure we had before, being that being a revi'it, right? Meaning a, you know, roughly 3 ounces of alcohol. And one who is intoxicated is somebody who is unable to talk in the presence of a king. Right, so the question is, so how much did you drink? If you drank too much, ideally you shouldn't drink at all. Right? If you're praying, if you had a little bit, not so bad. But if you had a lot, then, you know, that's really terrible and your prayers become an abomination. And in fact, in regards to that, while it might work for prayer, if you're a Kohen, I know we have some Kohen on as well tonight, but if you're a Kohen and you were to do chin, you were to do one of the avodot of a kohen, one of the services that a kohen would do in the mikdash while drunk, you are violating a biblical prohibition, and that is not considered to be a blessing at all if you were to do it. And that's why on Simchat Torah we move the birka kohenim from normally you do it during Musaf on Yom Tov in Chutz La'aretz, right? And outside in the diaspora, we normally say it at Musaf on Yom Tov. So instead, we move it to Shacharit because nobody's having their l'chaims, their kiddush is not before we get to is not before Shacharit. It's only between after laning, before Kafot, or depending on how on the schedule of your shul. So. Right. So, but on the other hand, we say that there's also the same in the Gemara. Irvin discusses the case of somebody who had too much to drink. Amar v'chanina, right? So, at a certain point, you reach this level of intoxication, that of the drunkenness of Lot, where you are not considered to be a functional human being anymore. And anything that occurs, you are considered to be exempt from all liability, meaning you're no longer required to do any mitzvot because you are no longer considered to be a person of the cognitive ability to actually do any mitzvot. Okay, so now just to summarize the four types of drinking we have there. So there's or lack thereof. So there's that, similarly, there's the ideal in terms of for prayer and for making lots of decisions of having none at all. There is drinking some amount, but you're still able to be in control of your facilities, your faculties, right? So that's, so that's being able to stand before a king. We had the drunk and unable to stand before a king, at which point your prayer becomes an abomination. And last, we have that of the, you drink like Lot did, right? Where he didn't even notice what his daughter, or that his daughters had slept with him, not only once, but twice. That is the, by far, the worst situation you can be in terms of alcohol. So, but as far as, right, which status we have and when, so it's not, right, so which one of the four we have here would you say you should definitely avoid no matter what? You got to pick one. Which one should you never be? And which ones could you say maybe there's a place for, but the place isn't during prayer, right? So which one, so what would be ideal, not ideal, potentially good, right? So which states should you, stay away from the four we have here?
So drunk light load is the worst because then you had forbidden sexual relations. By the way, same with Noah. He's also subject to a forbidden sexual relation.
Correct. According, yes. The Midrash says that he was raped, that he was castrated and raped by his son Cham. So yes, that could also happen, right? So that's one you definitely should stay away from. But as far as the first three, right, there seemingly is definitely a place for them. Just the place isn't during prayer, and it isn't, when learning Torah. But there is a place for it, just not necessarily there, and therefore it can be fine. But as far as ideally, what should you be doing? So to that, I'd like to turn to the words of Aaron Lichtenstein Zatzal when he's talking in context of a sikha he gave, I believe it was roughly over 30 years ago in Yeshivat Har Tzion, that he gave on the topic of drunkenness as learned from the Nazir. So he had discussed what a special trait of wine, right? That beyond representing physical pleasure in general, wine has a special nature. Besides just physical pleasure, as we saw from the blessings earlier. On the one hand, it can help bring about a raising of spirits. There are many contexts in which wine expresses joy and enhances it as well. This holds true on the subject, on the objective halakhic level, as expressed by the halakhic principle, the joyful song sung at the offering of sacrifice in the mikdash, accompanied by wine. Ein shira ela b'yayin. It is also true that the more subjective level, as expressed by the verse, that we say on Rosh Chodesh and Baruch Hinashi, as we quoted earlier, Yain Yisamach Vavanosh, wine gladdens the heart of man. It is for these reasons that wine represents at most happy occasions, such as weddings and Brit Milah, right? That's why it's there. On the communal and personal levels, wine can be a means to enhance a man's feelings. On the other hand, wine can also be the cause of drunkenness. If it is not controlled, drinking can bring about a loss of control and even deterioration of man's nature. When a person allows himself to lose some control in this area, he will very often be dragged along to a total loss of control. If he allows his drinking to overcome him, the results can be disastrous. It can even lead to the tearing apart of families. Can the same be said for chocolate, movies, or Coca-Cola? Do they bring a person to such great heights or terrible traumas? Wine is more significant than other pleasures in this regard. It has the potential to raise a person up or to destroy him. What determines which of these two extreme results one will bring about? The answer is control. If the person remains in control of his drinking, the wine can bring him joy. If, however, the person becomes enslaved to his drinking, it can have horrific results, and it is critical for a person to remain in control of his drinking. So what we're seeing here is that there is a twofold aspect to drinking. On the one hand, there is a potential positive that it can have, and on the other hand, there is a very, very steep negative that it can have as well. And as far as when to do each, so as in, there's no absolute answer that, you know, I'm not, again, not advocating for prohibition here, right? But as far as there are, clearly, as we've seen, there are times for use of wine and times when certainly you should not be using wine, right? So sometimes it might depend on when it is, right? Like what time of day it is. Are you in the middle of a prayer right now? Are you in the middle of doing service in the temple? Who are you with, right? Are you in a place where you'll be able to do it properly, or are you meaning at a meal or at a place where wine would be acceptable and make sense, as well as lead to potential benefits of enhancing the feelings you're experiencing? Or is it a situation where it actually can cause the reverse? Also, the question is also, is in, when you're drinking, why are you drinking? Are you drinking because you're interested in simply the rush from the bottle, or is it that you're drinking as towards a more positive end, right? Are you hiding in the bottle, or is the bottle simply something to enhance what you're currently enjoying and experiencing? There's also the very good question of the quantity as well, right? The first, you know, couple, we mentioned several levels you can be in terms of drunkenness, and there's a certain state that you definitely should ever be at. So this is also, I've not yet, you know, mentioned that there are many health issues with drinking, especially in terms of large amounts, especially in terms of if you were to do it on a regular basis in large amounts. For more on that, I can give you, there's a whole slew of literature on that. But generally, if you drink responsibly, meaning you don't drink too heavily, you drink, you know, at appropriate times in reasonable amounts. Kind of amount depends on your age, size, and weight. For more on that, please consult your local doctor. I cannot advise you on anything regarding that, right? But as far as the idea in general of wine, so again, so wine, again, you may have heard it being quoted that, you know, wine can, you know, help with your heart. So those studies are often overstated, and also in a very limited study in terms of for a very specific type of alcohol, namely red wine, it taken in moderation. But once it becomes excessive, then any positives can be replaced with negatives, such as apologize for the terrible sounding risk list, such as can lead to obesity, cirrhosis of the liver, problems of the lung, cancer, and more. Not to mention anything addictive, which on that note, before I forget, in terms of addiction, so that is not my expertise. There are many who are many orders of magnitude more qualified than I am to discuss the topic, which we'll actually be having a special panel on that on the 13th. So you see there on the flyer there, right? So it's going to be on Sunday, March the 13th at 10 a.m. So, but again, the main points that we're getting out from today is that alcohol definitely has its place in Judaism. But the question is, it's very subjective based on when, where, why, and how, as well as quantity of what you're drinking. Depending on those factors, will determine whether your drinking is something that is beneficial and rises you up, or it is something that is quite negative and actually drags you down to places you should not be. So if anybody has any questions in regards to alcohol, feel free to ask them now. Also, if anybody would like to sign up for the panel, wants to submit any anonymous questions, I posted a link in the chat. Feel free to put your email if you'd like me to get updates. And also, again, feel free to message me any way, shape, or form as well if you'd like to get them as well. And please let me know if you have any. Again, there are many other topics that will be covered in coming weeks in regards to other substances and their usage. So if you have any questions in regards to them as well, please let me know so I can make sure I properly research them prior to the session. Yes, Karen.
First of all, thank you for an interesting lecture. Number two, Do you think that there's any like response in Judaism to all the Avodah Zarah that might have involved drinking or that kind of, I mean, I know that there's rules regarding licentiousness, but is any of our rules in direct like opposition to whatever went on there?
Yes. I mean, as in, there is a certain spiritual enhancement that can be had by having alcohol. So as in, so there used to be, in addition to there, so in many idolatrous temples, they literally had a temple harlot, and they also would encourage you to drink to, and basically the temple of the god was basically the place where rules don't apply anymore, right? Whereas you approach the temple, what would normally be considered to be, you know, not considered to be done in good company, you never do, was okay because it was now condoned by the temple. For more on that, please see the Epic of Gilgamesh, where that is quite clearly the case. And those not, and that story is not unique. It's, there's many similar stories in basically every ancient Eastern religion. And also for more on that, please see look up the god Bacchus or Dionysus, depending on Roman or Greek, right? Where that literally had a god who is literally who you would go in and serve by drinking and licentiousness specifically, and that's basically all he did. So, you know, as the idea mentioned by the Sefer Chinuch, right? The idea is that when we want to serve God, we need to be serving God with all of our faculties. If our faculties are not there, it can lead to us being burned, as happened to Nadav Vaviu, right? And also, and we generally do our best to stay very far away from situations that will lead to God trying to burn us alive. So, excellent question. Thank you.
I'd just like to point out that both Noach and Lot, yes, they were the ones who were drunk, but the actual averos that were done by their children. Lot, his daughters, and Noach, his sons, which just shows us that when you are drunk, people can take advantage of you. You know, the actual, they were the ones who were drunk. In Nadav and Avihu, I think it's a different case. But here, they shouldn't have been drunk, but it was others who did things that they shouldn't have been done.
Correct, right? So, exactly. So if you put yourself in a state where you no longer have control, it's very easy for others to take advantage of you. So also, that's also why assassinations often tend to happen while the person is drunk or otherwise compromised, such as happened to Amnon, also happened to Sisera when he's killed by Yael. There it's drunk, he's not drunk on wine, he's drunk on milk, but whatever the substance is that makes you be unable to have full cognitive ability can have terrible consequences if you are not in the correct context. So there are contexts which can be safe. For more on that, we will discuss also that to more extent we get to week before Purim. We'll be discussing drinking on Purim and whether that's a good idea or bad idea. And there's a whole bunch of other, that's a whole separate discussion on that.
Thank you very much again. It's great.
My pleasure. Thank you for coming out.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you again for an interesting
night. Thank you.
Thank you.
My pleasure, you, everybody. And I hopefully I'll be seeing everybody here next week, same time.
Thank you.
Bye.